Senate Committee on Transportation will come to order. It's March 30th, 2005. And I'll be chairing this for a few minutes until Senator Bridger returns from testifying in the meeting. We're going to begin with public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 77. And I would call John Jackley, ODOT, to the
and
while John's taking his seat, Judith can give us a brief update on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 77 excludes certain activities of certified or licensed appraisers performed under contract with a public body that has condemnation authority from real estate appraisal activity otherwise regulated under certification or licensure. Basically, the bill would allow the certified or licensed property appraisers working under contract to the Oregon Department of Transportation or other public body to determine property values using an abbreviated process known as the appraisal waiver. The department, we have received no revenue impact on the measure. The fiscal statement that you'll find in your materials indicates that the department estimates that the savings net of one-time implementation costs, primarily that's administrative rule process costs, could total $63,200 in the 05-07 biennium and $90,950 in the 07-09 biennium. Again, that's savings. Those are savings. You have also the Dash 1 amendments, which exempt properties with a value of more than $10,000 from those that may be performed in compliance with the appraisal waiver process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Mr. Jackley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Jackley with the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation. With me is Dennis Weigel from our right-of-way section. I thought it might be useful just to recap real quickly why we'd like to see this bill happen in the first place. We acquire property through the course of our construction program. In order to acquire property, we have to assign a value to that property. And in the course of acquiring property, it's been our experience that between 400 and 500 properties per year are going to fall into a relatively low value. They might be worth $500. They might be worth a couple thousand dollars. We would prefer, and what Senate Bill 77 allows us to do in order to arrive at a proper value for these low cost acquisitions, is that we can currently use agency staff to do what's called an administrative valuation for that property. What we can't do without Senate Bill 77 is to allow the private sector to do this for us. We've been doing these kind of valuations for more than 15 years. They're approved by the Federal Highway Administration. And with Senate Bill 77, not only would our state agency be able to save money, but other public agencies, cities and counties in Oregon, would be able to use the private sector to do these kind of administrative valuations. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Weigel to go into some of the technical elements that we've been talking about.
Chair Whitson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dennis Weigel. I'm with the right-of-way section for ODOT. As Mr. Jackley has said, ODOT has been approved by federal law and allowed under state law for the past 15 years to do this administrative process, which we're referring to in this bill as an appraisal waiver. We're approved to do it up to a limit of $20,000 on simple, non-involved, straightforward valuation issues where there are no things requiring a more complex evaluation. We feel that the process has been used very well for the past 15 years. We've maintained standards which are required by Federal Highway. They're reviewed every year with Federal Highway. These same standards would be used and applied if this bill passes and we can use private sector appraisers managed to do the process for us. It all complies with the uniform standards for appraisal practices under Federal Highway Administration, not USPAP. And Federal Highway Administration standards for appraisal have existed for many years prior to the USPAP standards, which were the result of all the problems in the savings and loan industry. The property owners are under no requirement to use any particular type of evaluation process. They can have a knowledgeable relative give some information, some market information, and provide it to us during the course of negotiation. We will look at that, take that into account, see if it's something that's valid. This bill does nothing to change that safeguard to the property owners. We feel that this bill has been conducted on a very high level of professionalism by the agency over the past 15 years, and we feel that by allowing us to utilize private sector appraisers who are trained in valuation, oftentimes a lot better than our people, that have, you know, pledged a code of ethics for their organization, that this in no way increases the risk to the property owner that we're dealing with. If anything, I would say that it lowers the risk because the people we're using have a lot of training in valuing properties. We feel that, as Mr. Jackley said, it doesn't make a lot of sense to pay $2,000-$3,000 for an appraisal on a property when the valuation is $500, $1,000. It's a simple, straightforward valuation. We feel this is a better use of the taxpayers' dollars that we're working with. And we feel this will also provide some additional work, at least from the department, to the appraisal industry. Right now, we do about 400 of these a year in-house. Probably the majority of those would be going out to the private sector were this bill to be enacted. So for these reasons, we would ask your support for the bill, and I'm ready to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I do have a question. Would Senate Bill 77 eliminate the need for the USPAP standards to be utilized within these, the scope of these limited processes?
With the chair, with members of the committee, in doing this process, it would not be under the governance, if you will, of the USPAP standards, because this would be an administrative process, not defined as an appraisal process. USPAP oversees the private sector appraisal activities. It would continue to be under the standards set by Federal Highway Administration, which when we hire an appraiser now to do a full appraisal for us, the standards that we work under in eminent domain appraisal are and have always been Federal Highway appraisal standards. And Federal Highway and USPAP standards have acknowledged agreement with each other in the fundamentals of how they control the appraisal activities. This process, even though it's an administrative process, is under the oversight of Federal Highway Administration and under the oversight of ODOT as the lead agency for Federal Highway.
Well, is it your position that it's that the USPAP guidelines are unnecessary in this situation, or is it your position that those guidelines are too inflexible to be done economically within the scope of these smaller appraisals?
Chair Woodson, members of the committee, I would say that the USPAP standards are not necessary in this instance because, first of all, it's not an appraisal activity by law, and secondly, because all the safeguards that USPAP was created to maintain in the appraisal industry are being controlled in this process by the Federal Highway standards and by ODOT as the overseer for Federal Highway. So I would say yes, in doing this this type of a procedure for ODOT, the USPAP standards would not be required or necessary, and it wouldn't endanger anything at all.
Thank you.
Question. Regarding the workload for ODOT, My understanding is that under the bill that's envisioned, that some of this, not a good portion of that work, will be contracted outside of the department. If that's so, what does that mean for those individuals that are currently doing this work within ODOT?
Chair Whitsitt, Senator Prezansky, yes, that's correct. Most of this we would anticipate would be contracted out. Our people would be focusing more intensely on the acquisition and relocation aspects. We acquire about 500 to 600 properties a year, and that's before OTIA, and with OTIA that is increasing. It would enable our people to be able to utilize their time more effectively in trying to give more attention to the acquisition end of the file, if you will, rather than the valuation. And one of the things I do want to stress is that our people in doing these 400 valuations right now, the intent of the valuation is that it's a pretty quick process. It doesn't have to go through the formal rigorous appraisal review procedure that an appraisal has to go through. So our people are freed up, but it's not like there's going to be a lot of downtime that, you know, we have to come up with something to try to fill it. I mean, there's more than enough activity right now. These are pretty quick. Individually, these are fairly quick processes to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have the members of the Appraisal Coalition, Larry Uffner, Brian Glaubil, and Roxanne Gillespie. I hope I did not butcher your names too badly. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Whitsitt and other members of the committee. I'm going to start. I'm Larry Offner. I'm from Hillsboro, Oregon, obviously Oregon. And I've been an appraiser here in the state since 1974. We three are fee appraisers in the private sector. I think the private sector was referenced as somehow benefiting from this. And you're going to hear some of our disagreement with the points that they've made. I'm a partner in a firm. I've been doing condemnation appraisals for many years for both the property owners and for agencies, including ODOT. They've been a client of mine, and I have a great deal of respect for them, though I'm here to disagree with this particular proposed action. I'm certified under our state licensing laws. I hold an MAI designation with the Appraisal Institute, which is an international professional appraisal organization. I've served in many statewide chapter positions and committees, and was one of the original drafters assisting in drafting our state license laws, so I'm very familiar with what we had intended originally in that drafting and trying to ensure that they were fair and that they would assure the best for the public that we could provide, which was quite a bit of the purpose of having licensing and certification in the first place. We also were intent on containing the exemptions. If we ought to have licensing, it ought to be for everybody. That was pretty much our theory when we started the whole thing. Originally, what's good for one ought to be good for all. Let's keep exemptions to a minimum. The last 6 years, I've served on the Appraisal Standards Board of the Appraisal Foundation. That was established by Congress to create, edit, and interpret, promulgate the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, the USPAP, which have been adopted by all 50 states, the territories, and many of the private and public bodies, including federal agencies. And I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 77, and I've brought along a letter. I think you may have already received copies of it to distribute. I won't bore you with reading the whole letter. I'm going to try to highlight the main points. It's not in the public's best interest, and it's unfair to citizens. The primary purpose of licensing appraisers in the state, and indeed all of the states, really was to protect public's interest by mandating a common basis of uniform ethics and standards that would be adhered to by every appraiser in every assignment, regardless of who the client was or what the amount of the appraised value was. Same rationale really does apply to all other forms of professions who are licensed, and it seems to me that it would be just as illogical to provide exemptions for attorneys to provide a legal opinion of something that seemed rather minor, and then it wouldn't count as a legal opinion. So they would have no nobody would have a recourse to go after them. So in essence, I see this as a request to create a non-appraisal appraisal, if you will. Let's have appraisers do them, but let's not call them appraisal activity. Let's not call them appraisals, but we do want appraisals. And it seems to me that we're here to debate language that ought not to be there. It's not in the public's interest because the public deserves an appraisal as a basis for an offer presented by an agency, in my view. If they are presented, there's currently a waiver that already exists for staff of agencies to provide an opinion of value and to have support when they hand it to a property owner whose property is being condemned. If you hire an appraiser to do this, it seems to me it ought to be one who is bound by USPAP, who's bound to follow the rules, and who can be disciplined properly if there's a problem with it. By counting it as non-appraisal activity, there are no safeguards in that regard at all. So I don't think there's the proper accountability or oversight to assure fairness to property owners in those situations. It creates an undesirable precedent because the next thing you're going to hear in next session probably would be some other group coming in here saying, gosh, we've got minor loan appraisals or something like that, bankers may want to say, why do we need to have it? Let's have appraisers do them. Let's not count them as appraisal activity because they're fairly minor. Let's just have appraisers make value opinions but not count them under our state licensing laws. Finally, I don't believe this is necessary at all. I did communicate and send a letter to Bruce Warner of ODOT, volunteering to assist in educating properly the agencies around the state and appraisers about what USPAP allows in terms of flexibility. There's a great deal of flexibility the document allows appraisers in terms of limited assignments. If there is good reason that there's a simple acquisition and there's an awareness that it's simple, there you can create a simple, non-complex appraisal scope of work to handle that. Just as an engineer might for something that wasn't going to be very complicated. You don't have to move heaven and earth in order to solve the problem like that. So the rules already in place allow simple, non-complex scopes of work. It's an education process because many agencies don't realize that they can work with an appraiser to create a less expensive, quicker product. Initially, you may hear that the ACLB had been willing to support this subject to certain conditions, but those conditions, they had granted their support at a meeting last fall, but those conditions are not present in the bill you have before you. Therefore, in my mind, that support would maybe be withdrawn if we can present our case to them April 18th at their meeting. We've spoken with the ACLB and we're going to be doing that. In addition, they were not aware of the concerns that we are raising right now. So, finally, the Uniform Act, I'm very familiar with. I worked on the behalf of the Appraisal Standards Board in Washington, D.C., in trying to assure that the Uniform Act changes and the regulations regarding appraising that have just been adopted were consistent with USPAP. And the administrative waiver that appears in the Uniform Act that was being referenced earlier, I believe, is quoted in that act as being intended for non-appraisers. It's not intended for appraisers to follow. And what the state's asking here is that appraisers actually be allowed to provide appraisals that are not going to be counted as appraisals under the state law. And that was never the intent of the Uniform Acts waiver. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to provide my input on this issue. And if you have any questions of me, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, the other two are ready to provide input as well.
I think we'll continue with the panel and then ask questions.
Okay. Senator Berger and members of the committee, I'm Brian Glanville. I'm Managing Director of Integra Realty Resources in Portland, and I've been a licensed appraiser in Oregon for 27 years. I am the past national president of the Appraisal Institute, which is the oldest and largest professional organization for appraisers in the United States. And I've recently been appointed as United States Representative to the International Valuation Standards Committee. I also assisted in writing Oregon's appraisal law in 1990, which require the federal government to provide licensed appraisers subject to standards and ethics so they would have uniformity to help protect the public and make sure that they got a reasonable product. That's why USPAP was originally written, to protect the public and make sure that we had that uniformity and those protections. This bill allows appraisers to do something less than what an appraisal is. The document, from talking to the representative of ODOT, would not be necessarily reviewed by ODOT. It would not be subject to review by the Appraisal Certification and Licensure Board. Thus, if my appraisal or one of my people's appraisals has a mistake in it, no one catches it. So the public gets an erroneous product that could harm them. The product is also extremely limited because it doesn't meet the basic requirements of what should be an appraisal for understanding of that document. Hence, it could be misleading and confusing to the public when they get it, trying to determine whether or not they should take the offer from the state. Thirdly, the property owner doesn't have the same opportunity as the state. They have to go out and hire an appraiser that has to follow those standards, so they don't have the same equal protections. I echo Mr. Offner's views regarding 77 as being unnecessary, and it may actually preclude members of the Appraisal Institute from participating and doing this kind of work. Our ethical requirements require anyone who's a member of the Appraisal Institute that if you give an opinion of value, that is an appraisal, and it is subject to USPAP. So if one of my people, if this bill passes, does this kind of work, they'll be subject to ethical problems potentially from the Appraisal Institute. What we say is if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it probably is a duck. You can't get around it. You've done an appraisal. Do it by the rules. All that needs done is for the Appraisal Certification and Licensure Board, along with the assistance from Mr. Offner, to write a guidance note that will assist appraisers to understand how they can do this type of work under the standards. Then it meets the requirements and of getting something quicker and less expensive for ODOT, but it still meets the requirements of what an appraisal is, and it is subject to review if someone is taking advantage of it or isn't doing competent work. That's in the best interest, in my opinion, of the people of Oregon. I urge you to vote against this unnecessary legislation, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roxanne Gillespie. I'm a fee appraiser in Eugene, Oregon. I've been practicing in Eugene since 1985. I also hold the MAI designation from the Appraisal Institute. I also have done numerous appraisals for condemnation purposes, small acquisition, large acquisition. I also have several independent clients as well. I also am the past chair of the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board. I served as a governor appointment for 8 years, 2 terms total, and I was the chair for the last 6 years of my terms with the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board. I was involved in drafting our current law, 674, from the start. I've been involved with it ever since. Follow it through. I am opposed to Senate Bill 77 and the proposed changes to allow an appraiser waiver. There are reasons that I'm opposed to it. One, I find it confusing for the public. I don't think it's in the best interest of the public that they would say, is this an appraisal or is this not an appraisal? Which is it? Also, the ODOT and the government agencies are currently exempt from 674, and it is 674-100, Section 2A through H. There is a list of people that are exempt from our law already, and the government agencies are exempt. They do fit within that. Thirdly, I am concerned with the enforcement. If there is an appraisal waiver and the public is done wrong in some sense, who's there to enforce this? What is there to be enforced, if there's anything? Estimating market value is a very important facet of what appraisers do. We have standards we must live by. We have requirements. We have 674. We also have our administrative rules to follow. This allows for accountability of the appraisers and accountability to the public. I agree with Mr. Glanville and Mr. Offner that to allow the ACLB to issue some kind of guideline or guidance to the appraisers in our state that would allow them to do that. If you're not aware, the ACLB does put out a newsletter quarterly, which could be used as the vehicle to inform appraisers. Again, I thank you for your time and listening, and if you have questions, please feel free to ask.
Thank you. In performing a non-appraisal, as you put it, Mr. Offner, if that is unethical to do by an appraiser, then who would perform that service?
Under current law, the staff of any agency can perform such non-appraisals. Attorneys are allowed to offer those opinions. I spoke with an attorney that says he does a lot of this kind of offering of opinions of low-value takings. Appraisers can be hired currently to appraise these, and are being sometimes hired to appraise low-value takings. So we currently can do this work, and when we do it, we have to follow the standards.
And then could you give us just an approximation of the differences in costs for what you call a non-appraisal as opposed to USPAP limited approval appraisal?
You know, I've thought about, when I've read this, how... You know, what if I was approached to do one of these non-appraisals? What standards would I have to follow? The testimony earlier suggests that there are certain standards I would have to follow in doing that. I'd have to have some comparable data. I'd have to have some support, some reasoning. But apparently, I could just write a letter instead of writing a little longer report. So it might save some money in report writing. But I, honestly, if I have to have support and reasoning and rationale, that's what's required by USPAP as well, and use recognized methods and techniques. I don't know that it would save a whole lot, to be honest. And if they're looking for somebody to just simply write a letter and say it's worth $3,500 based on my experience, first of all, I don't think that's what the public deserves or ought to be getting. And secondly, I can't do that. I'd have to research and figure out what an appropriate value was. So it would take me more time. Maybe it's a difference between, I really don't know, maybe $2,000 and $3,000 or $2,000, $2,500 or something. I just don't think it's a big savings, as the savings would be if we were to create an appropriate scope of work approach to the problem solving. I just don't think any of the agencies or appraisers really have gone that far with this yet.
If I may, Madam Chair and committee members, I want to make sure that that's clear, that we can design a scope of work that can be less than the full appraisal process, which is what Mr. Offner was referring to. For instance, if it is a simple problem with land where we only have to do the one approach to value with land sales, and if we can shorten up what we have to write and how much research we have to do, you can cut back on the amount of time, and that's where the savings would come in. But it's the scope that you have to design. Currently, at the present time, appraisers who are asked to do this work are probably doing more of the full compliance than a limited scope type of an assignment.
Any questions?
One question.
Yes.
Ms. Gillespie, you mentioned in your testimony regarding the exemption as to who can do that work. Could you give me that cite?
Certainly. It's 674-100.
Thank you.
Section 2A through H.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Call John Brown, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Brown. For the record, my address is 1260 Charnelton Street in Eugene. I, too, am a licensed fee appraiser. I've been doing that in excess of 25 years, and I also hold the designation of MAI from the Appraisal Institute. Like those who testified before me, I also do quite a bit of work eminent domain, both for public agencies and for private property owners. I'm here to speak in support of this bill, and for a variety of reasons. And it's not to take issue with what's been said, but to bring a different perspective. I'll give you a couple of examples of jobs I've recently completed for ODOT and other public agencies. They've asked that we appraise property, and the previous testimony is correct. There are certain rules that we have to adhere to now to comply with state law, and I try my best to do so. But to do so, the fees for my services to appraise a parcel of land that encompasses 25 square feet of land only with no improvements was $3,000. Now, anybody can do the math. If 25 square feet is worth $10 a square foot or $20 a square foot or $40 a square foot, it's almost irrelevant. Why would you pay me $3,000 to tell you to pay a property owner $50 or $100? Because there's a threshold where you go through this entire appraisal process and your estimate of just compensation could be $75 or $100, and that's not enough to bring somebody to the table to figure their tax issues about filing a tax return and closing escrow and dealing with the release of a mortgage lien holder. There's a minimum administrative fee. So you pay me $3,000 to do an appraisal to tell you that the estimate of just compensation is $400, and then I tell you to pay him $750 because that's probably a minimum threshold to bring him to the table. Now you multiply this on a line appraisal where we do 20 or 30 properties where there are very minimal takings, and you can see what happens. You've paid me $50,000 or $60,000 to do a job that administratively now ODOT is doing that we could, through this work product, subject to interpretation by professional organizations we belong to and their interpretation of whether or not this is compliant, do that work for a fee, and what I believe is to bring a higher level of expertise than currently is being presented by state employees. That's not to say that they can't do a good, fair, equitable job, but I see this as allowing a greater level of expertise to be brought to the property owners. This would not negate this job being done. This, to me, would allow this job to be done by people that might have a higher level of degree of competency and expertise. So that being said, I support this in concept. Whether or not the devil in the details, I can't speak to that, but ideally I think you can see my point. Yes, this may cost me money, but that's not the reason I'm here. The reason I'm here is because to me it makes sense. It doesn't make sense to pay these huge fees for these minor takings. When it's appropriate to engage a professional appraiser to have a fully self-document, I wholeheartedly encourage that. But when you're doing the minor little takings, the last example I'll talk about, I just finished one in Halsey. It's a gravel driveway on a 400-acre parcel of ryegrass land. And you paid me $3,000 to tell you what that was worth. I can't tell you what it's worth, but it was worth a very minimal amount because you only took 5 feet off the driveway and the home was a half mile away. With that, if you have any questions, I would entertain them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, a disclosure. I know John Brown for my work and his work with the Eugene Police Commission. So we've had some of these discussions before. John, what I want to ask you, we've heard from Ms. Gillespie as to where the exemptions are. Is this something that, is there a concern with the appraisals and making sure that we don't put people in an awkward position to actually bid for the work, that we'd want to put something within the exceptions that will allow for these minor takings? It's now, my understanding is the department's doing it now up to $20,000. This bill would actually permit the work to be contracted out up to where it's going to be up to $10,000. Is that something that would make the industry, your industry, more comfortable? Or is there other things, as we've heard from the other two people of the first panel, that would be a concern within the standards that are there within the organization?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, their concerns are all very well founded. I don't totally disagree with their concerns, and their primary concerns are about the waiver. I don't see this as allowing anybody else to do this work. There are waivers now that I totally disagree with about allowing attorneys and CPAs to testify in certain venues as to fair market value. I see this as being a bill of common sense. because an appraiser that has to adhere to competency provisions and professional ethics and standards, if for any reason they can't assert that this work product or the service they're rendering is not fair and unbiased, then they should step aside and not accept the assignment and do so. And I can't say to how some person may or may not react to that. I can't speak for the industry. I'm not here as an industry spokesman. I'm here as an individual. But I can say from my perspective, I don't see it as a problem with the industry. I see it as being allowing a governmental agency to A, save money, B, provide a better work product for the consumer, and still have the option of doing things the way they're done currently.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
We called John Oshill and Bob Keith to the testimony, please. Thank you, gentlemen. And if you could compress your testimony as much as possible, that would certainly help our committee get through our workload today.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Whitsitt, members of the committee. I'm John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. By my way of experience, 18 years Public Works Director for Tillamook County, lots of property acquisition, almost all of it through federal aid projects. A great many times would be a case of a bridge that needs guardrail on each end, and we need less than a quarter acre on four pieces of pasture. A lot of time for this method of acquisition was important. The short testimony here is, if you think of most of the agencies who are small, don't have a staff of appraisers and folks that can do all of the acquisition steps, they hire this work done. This bill allows a higher quality of work to be done. Basically, the existing law as it stands, we can do this valuation ourselves with one of our staffs. You know, Public Works Director comes out and makes his best stab at it. Or they can hire another public agency, such as ODOT, but they cannot hire a consultant to do the same thing. In this day and age where we're getting more and more projects, ODOT is getting more and more busy, they are not available, it is becoming more and more the option that we have the choice of doing it ourselves or hiring a consultant to do it. But right now, under existing law, we don't have the ability to do that. This law would simply allow us to hire someone more qualified to do it. We understand the concerns. I believe they probably do need to set up some standards so they can clearly identify this type of project and set their standards so that they should be allowed to do it. And I understand that looking within their internal profession, they probably need to do that. But from our simple profession, from where we sit, this law doesn't change how we acquire. It just impacts who we get to make that call. Do we do it ourselves? Do we hire someone more qualified? We are in support. I've been advised that I can tell you the League of Oregon Cities is also in support. Any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Chair Verger, Vice Chair Whitsitt, and members of the committee, my name is Bob Keith, and I'm the administrator of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. ODOT approached the board last summer with a legislative concept, which was 413, was a predecessor to this bill. The board actually supported the concept under the condition that the board would have, through administrative rules, the ability to control the threshold amount. I'd be happy to explain why if you ask me, but in the interest of time, I'll skip that. But there was a condition to its approval. This bill does not contain that language. Therefore, at best, at this time, I'd say that the board is neutral on the bill. There is a meeting scheduled on April 18th, and I'm sure that they'll take a position one way or another or remain neutral. But that concludes my comments. So.
Thank you, Mr. Keith. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 77? Hearing no one, we'll close that hearing.
Chair? Thank you, Vice Chair Whitsitt. Good job. I'm going to open a public hearing now on Senate Bill 894. I'm going to move the from the agenda and move it up. We have someone that's more than 100 miles away. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 894. And I'm going to call Bob Russell, along with Representative Barnhart and Senator Johnson to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I hope you don't mind my having these distinguished visitors with you.
I'm honored.
Very good. Would you mind if Mr. Russell just gives a little bit of the opening of this bill?
Fine.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association, and thank you for the opportunity. I did testify once before, and my written testimony is in the record, and indicated at that time what we were trying to accomplish. I think what I'd like to do is sort of clarify the amendments so that everybody knows what we're talking about, because at this point it's a substantially different bill than it was during the last public hearing. The two amendments that I have drafted with the permission of the chair and I've discussed with the members of the committee. One is the dash two amendments, and the dash twos make it very clear, and it's a very short amendment, make it very clear that we're not talking about freight routes in this statute. It removes all reference to freight route from that particular statute. So what it does is it takes away, if you look at the existing bill, just for your clarification, there's the language that's bolded. It was the new language. That comes out entirely. And then in line 10, you have the term freight route. That comes out, and then it's that term freight route is replaced by a national highway system highway. There are a highway that is part of the national highway system. And then there's one other change to that amendment. There are a series of exclusions that from this statute for safety, access, considerations, and this dash two amendments adds changes in mobility standards approved by the commission. So essentially what the dash two amendments do is they clarify what we were trying to do with the original bill and clean up the statutory language. Then you may recall on the same agenda last time we had Senate Bill 566 that was introduced at the request of Senator Morissette, I believe, and he had amendments to that one at that time. And what we did is folded those amendments in the dash four amendments plus an expansion of those into what is now the new 894. The dash four amendments basically make it very clear that Highway 126 from the eastern city limits of Springfield to the intersection of Oregon Route 126 with US 20 or US Route 101 from the intersection of US Route 101 and US Route 26 to the intersection of US Route 101 and Oregon Route 126 may not be designated as freight routes by the Oregon Transportation Commission.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think Mr. Russell may have forgot one to point out one other change that's on the dash twos. That's on the dash twos line six. I didn't hear him state that we also are going to be inserting changes in mobility standards approved by the commission.
In line 11.
Okay. On line 11. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruszynski, if I didn't say that, I intended to.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Stay right there. We may get back to you. I'm going to move now to Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Yes. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. I was originally here to thank Mr. Russell for being so accommodating to concerns raised by my county commissioners with respect to 101. And I had the opportunity to have a brief consultation with Representative Barnhart out in the hall, and I've managed managed to confuse myself with respect to what is or is not going to now be considered a freight route, whether or not we are designating as a freight route any highway that is part of the national highway system. That's the definition in I don't have the original bill and language right in front of me, in Section 1, and then the exceptions in Section 2, and I'm here simply now to edify myself and make sure that if this bill moves forward, that it was through the cooperation of Mr. Russell and the Dash 4 amendments that took contentious parts of 101 that traverses my district out of the bill. And so I eagerly await my colleague's, Representative Barnhart's remarks and Mr. Russell's response, and I could go away quite happy.
Okay. All right. Representative Barnhart, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate very much being here. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, which is Central Lane and Linn Counties. I've been looking at this issue for some time now, starting with a very large town hall meeting along Highway 126, the largest town hall meeting I've ever attended, several hundred people there, involving the issue of whether Highway 126 should be part of the freight route system in the state of Oregon. The reason that we're concerned about 126 and also about the section of 101 that Senator Johnson referred to is that these roads are narrow, twisting, contain thousands, literally, of driveways and intersections, and are used for many, many uses other than hauling freight. While they certainly do have trucks moving on them, they're used for many other things. In the case of 101, I think I can speak for that, as well as for Highway 126, one of the major uses and real uses that we ought to be thinking about in the Oregon economy is for tourism and fisheries. Highway 126 travels along one of the most pristine rivers in the United States, the Mackenzie River. It's a great river for tourists and for fisheries. It also is the water source for Eugene Water and Electric Board that services Eugene, parts of Springfield, and other communities. So it's important for us to maintain the pristine nature of that river. But several of us in the Lane County delegation have submitted a variety of bills to deal with this issue. Since we're talking about this one today, let me make just a couple of comments. What Amendment 2 does, as I see it, is renames freight route and simply changes it to a highway that's part of the national highway system, leaving out the name altogether, but doesn't change the effect of the bill, which basically is to require that there not be any permanent reduction in vehicle carrying capacity when except for the reasons that are listed in line 10 and 11 of the major of the bill. And this is willy-nilly across the state, regardless of the fact that the highways run through main streets in a lot of towns. And otherwise, we're not studying any of these things. We're simply designating them as a highway as part of the national highway system, and therefore having these effects. That's the dash fours, as I read them, do have the effect of exempting Highway 126 and US 101 from designated as freight routes. It would not exempt them, because they are part, as I understand it, of the national highway system, from the restrictions contained in Section 1 of the bill, which is precisely the reason that we were here trying to oppose those areas being designated as freight routes in the first place, or among the reasons that we were here trying to do that. I see this whole line of bills, if I could, Madam Chair, as an attempt to short-circuit or circumvent the process that currently resides in the Oregon Transportation Commission and simply have the legislature do this designation. Now, that may be, in fact, what the legislature wants to do. I hope that isn't what we end up doing, but instead that we are able to do some continued planning on specialized roads like Highway 126 and Highway 101 and probably a variety of other places in the state. I'm certainly not opposed to the designation of additional freight routes in Oregon. We need freight routes. We need to move large amounts of freight in Oregon. Our economy depends upon it. But I think willy-nilly and kind of blanket statewide designation of these roads in a way that has the result of designating them as freight routes, even if we don't call it that, is not necessarily in the best interests of the state of Oregon. That's my concern about this bill.
Representative Barnhart, when you speak of 126, you mean 126 East.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, I'm talking about from Springfield
right.
up the mountain.
That's right.
From Springfield West is a completely different kind of, I'm sorry, from Eugene West is a completely different kind of road.
Yes, and strongly supported by the people who live along that route.
Exactly right. There are fewer driveways, and thank you for the clarification, because I did misspeak. There are fewer driveways, there are far fewer intersections. The road has a completely different character
right.
between Eugene and the coast than it does from Springfield up the mountain.
Right.
And in that sense, that piece of road from Springfield up the mountain has a character very similar to the road on Highway 101 that we're talking about here.
Very scenic. All right. Thank you both. Would you like to respond while they're here before they leave?
Madam Chairman, thank you very much. You know, we continue to have confusion about what does it mean to be a freight route. And maybe I can sort of dissect this a little bit and bring some clarity to this discussion. When we talk about the national highway system, that is the system that's been put in place since the Eisenhower administration for the purposes of national defense and for the movement of freight. So that system has been in place for a long, long time. It's kind of interesting, as I recall from my original testimony, the national highway system is about 4% of our total roads and streets in this country. It carries about 40% of the total traffic, about 70% of the freight traffic, and 90% of the tourist traffic. So the national highway system is also extremely important to our tourist industries. So you've already got a system that's part of the national network to deal with freight. So one of the things that we wanted to make clear is, as you may recall, last time when I testified, I said, from the trucking industry's perspective, we want to maintain that balance between commerce and communities. And what we were after was the hole in the air that was large enough to drive a big truck through. And I think that's what the Dash 2 amendments do. They say, on the national highway system, we have that hole in the air. Now, that's very different than the designation of a state freight route. And it's part of the reason that we came here to the legislature to solve this problem. When the Oregon Transportation Commission designates a freight route under the provisions of the highway plan, it brings all kinds of additional things into play, much of which are land use related. And we've heard concerns about access. There are some prohibitions against access when it's a state-designated freight route. In this particular statute, what we're talking about today, there is an exclusion. Access does not bring this statute into play. So there's none of that kind of concern with what we're doing on the national highway system. There's also some with a state-designated freight route. If a community wants to create a downtown or an urban business area and goes to the commission and gets approval to set up to do an STA or a UBA, a special transportation area, which is a downtown area, or a UBA, which is an urban business area, and then there's an additional planning requirement, land use planning requirement, that's placed on local government and their management plans, and there's a number of pieces to those plans. When we were talking about freight routes last year, there was a lot of opposition to that additional burden on local governments for planning, the implications for access, and from my perspective, that wasn't what I was after, so I was not interested in pursuing that any longer because it was just upsetting folks like on the McKenzie and on Highway 101. So I thought we could accomplish what I needed in that balancing in a much simpler way. And that was the purpose of 894. The Dash 2 amendments accomplish what I'm after, which is the hole in the air, while not bringing to the table all of the implications of a state freight route. With the Dash 4 amendments, it becomes very clear that those implications of a state freight route will never happen on 126 and up the McKenzie and on 101 from 26 to 126. So I hope that that clarifies the difference between what we're doing. We're not substituting one for another, and we're not calling a duck a chicken. They are very different things. And from our perspective, it's the balancing of allowing that truck to go through with the community the way they want to conduct business and the way they want their communities to live.
Madam Chair, again for the record, Betsy Johnson, I have no objection to what Mr. Russell has just stated. I am here to make sure that what Section 2 and the Dash 4s giveth to my constituents, Section 1 and the Dash 2s don't taketh away.
Right.
I would like to leave this room with the absolute understanding that U.S. 101 from the intersection of U.S. 101 and U.S. Route 26 to the intersection of U.S. Route 101 and Oregon Route 126 will never be a freight route. And I think that is just what Mr. Russell has explained, and I want to say publicly how much I appreciate his cooperation in helping to assuage the concerns of my constituents. So I believe I arrived happy, I got confused, and I'm leaving happy.
All right. Representative Garner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate both the explanation and the remarks made by the good senator. I just want to make certain that it's clearly understood that when we are talking about the changes that the Dash 2s made, we are making a real change, a significant change, in the current statute. Because the current statute says that ORS 363.215 applies when it applies to reduction of vehicle carrying capacity. I think that hole in the air that he's talking about of an identified freight route when altering, relocating, or changing, and so forth. What the change makes is it takes out that identified freight route and really puts in the whole system instead. So I think that's it's very important to understand that that's a change that's being made. And that, I think, while I definitely appreciate the changes that he's making with the Dash 4s and the effects that will have on the two highways that we're talking about, I still have the concerns that I indicated earlier about making this kind of blanket change without evaluating other parts of the highway system that none of us in the room know anything about, and yet making very substantive changes in line 10 of the bill. And I think I understand the change that Mr. Russell's talking about. I think it is important for the committee to understand that that is a significant and substantive change from the current law.
Well, we talked a lot about unintended consequences and the devil in the detail, so I think that you're going there. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Russell, two questions. One from his constituents in Prattville. They were concerned that there's no national highway system highway that goes through Prattville. Ergo, by the original wording of the bill, there would have been no freight route to Prattville. And, of course, Prattville is the home of Les Schwab, among others. So they were concerned about that. Are you confident that your amendments have addressed that issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I haven't made that. The amendments do not make that a freight route, and I believe you're talking about the route between Madras and Prattville.
From Redmond to Prattville, for anywhere from Prattville.
Well,
I like that.
If you look in your bill packets, and if you can pull out the testimony that I gave you at the last hearing, There was a map that I provided to you.
Yes.
That has the state freight system in yellow, yeah. And then it has those highways in purple that are part of the national highway system that are not part of the state freight system. So to make it real clear what we were talking about, I think I provided this to you folks as well.
Absolutely.
So there is between Redmond and Prineville, Highway 26, and that is part of the national highway system, and that would be, the hole in the air would be preserved for that particular route. I've also had a member of the legislature come up to me and say that the highway between Madras and Prineville needs to be designated, and it is not, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't be added with a request to the Department of Transportation.
All right, I'm going to get the three of you to stand back, and I'm going to call...
Before they stand back, I don't want to confuse Senator Johnson, but I do have one question.
Okay.
Bob, I didn't hear, Mr. Russell, in your testimony, the one thing that I've just got these amendments, so I went through and I basically blind engrossed them so I can get what how it's going to read. And there's one part in here on the dash fours that no one's talked about, and it says a freight route, which I thought freight route was coming out of the thing, is now back in on the dash fours, means a highway that is designated a freight route from the Oregon Highway Plan.
Right.
And I don't know from all the maps that you've given us, and Senator Wissett and I have talked about earlier, what is the Oregon Highway Plan, and are those highways different from what's on this state highway freight system?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, the yellow are the freight routes under the highway plan.
All right.
Senator Wissett.
Madam Chair, once again, Mr. Russell, the other question is in the dash four amendments you've successfully taken out, those two sections, one of Highway 126 and one of 101. Are there other sections of highway that we're going to find people queuing up wanting to take out, for instance, between Highway 140 and I-5 through White City and Central Point?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I certainly hope not. And I have not heard of any other, nobody has approached me and asked that any other highways be treated similarly.
Okay. Do you think the potential is there for some other requests for exclusions?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think the potential is certainly there. For whatever reason, the term freight route scares people. They believe that if their highway is a freight route, then that means that there's going to be more trucks. That's not the case. The trucks are going to go where the freight is, irregardless of where we draw the lines on the map. That's just sort of the reality of commerce when the trucking industry transports 72% of the tons of freight that move in this state. And we're the foundation of the economy. And all I'm asking for is within an environment of constrained funding where we don't have enough money to expand our highways to accommodate the projection and vehicle traffic that we expect in the next 10 or 15 years, the least we can do for the sake of our economy is preserve that hole in the air on the major routes in the state of Oregon.
Okay, I'm going to get you to stand back. We have a long list of people. I'm going to call Roger Bennett, Randy Tucker, and Anthony Vito. All right, welcome. Roger, you go first. You live in Huntington Hospital.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to speak to a very narrow portion of this concept today, and as I learned from the testimony before me, at this point it's a concept that I'm talking about. The city of Florence is very interested in the designation of freight routes as such. We've understood and have studied this issue for some length of time, and I think it's probably part of your record that at some point in time we wrote a rather strong letter encouraging the designation of Route 126 as it lies west of Eugene as a freight route, and would also include the Eugene Beltway as part of that, because that road in particular is our access to market. We view the designation of freight route as beneficial to our community in two ways. First of all, it tends to make the design of the roads that had that designation safer and easier to travel, and there's a great deal of competition between existing slow-moving traffic and existing freight that travels back and forth across that highway already. The second thing we look at is the possibility for increased economic development opportunity. We're very concerned about the jobs that don't exist in our community. While we're growing very rapidly, we're growing with people who don't work for a living and don't provide good jobs for people who do. So we have available land. We have an aggressive marketing program to actually put people to work in the Florence in Florence area. I came today to speak to what our understanding was of the original amendment proposal to Senate Bill 894 with regard to Highway 101. It was our understanding that the portion of Highway 101 south of the city of Florence was not included as a freight route designation, and that's what we seek to achieve at this point. We believe strongly that economic development opportunity exists not only in our community, but in what we call the Bay Area, the area around Coos Bay and North Bend. We view the fact that people of family age who would seek to support their families through industrial development could very well operate not only in Florence, but in the Coos Bay area. So we see that route between Florence and Coos Bay as a route, as a facility of opportunity for our economic development program. So my testimony apparently is going to relate to what's been called earlier today as the Dash 4 amendment, and it appears that the city of Florence's plan would essentially be empowered if that were to happen, with one caveat, and I think that the issue of commission approval of plans having to do with access or safety should be discussed specifically with regard to our community. Florence has gone through a multi-year, in fact, nearly six-year planning effort of what we call our downtown plan, which was supported through an SDA grant for ODOT and was participated in the planning process by ODOT planners and ODOT staff. So we have a very laboriously and finely crafted plan for downtown development, which includes a nine-block section of Highway 101, and we seek to preserve that plan. We'd like to do it without going back to the commission a second time to get that approved. So if the Dash 2 amendments would require that, we would somehow hope that that would be dealt with. We thank you for your work. We understand your concern for all of our local communities, and we would answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'm going to just take an opportunity to thank Roger Bennett. His city has been in my district through two sessions in the House and now in the Senate. And I wish I could clone you, and every city manager would be just like you. How's that?
I'm very flattered, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for coming today all the way from Florence. All right. Randy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and it's the first opportunity I've had to testify before your committee. Pleased to be here. You should have in the record a letter that was sent in prior to your first hearing on this bill. The hearing was scheduled on March 7th, which was a day when virtually every, you do have it in the record, okay, when virtually every public elected official in the metro, the Portland metropolitan area that works on transportation was off to Washington, D.C. to go look for transportation money. And But Councillor Burkholder, Councillor Rex Burkholder of the Metro Council, who also chairs the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, which is the body that advises the Metro Council on transportation matters and also programs a lot of the transportation money that comes in from the federal government, sent in a note expressing some concerns. Since that time, we've been on sort of a steep learning curve about the specifics of the national highway system and what exactly this bill would mean for the Portland metropolitan area. And over the last couple of weeks, I've had many hallway or cafe conversations with Mr. Russell trying to make sure that we know which end is up. You'll note that I checked sort of between the oppose and neutral boxes on the form. Just consider me frowning right now and not expressing some concerns and hoping that they can be resolved.
We call that riding the fence.
That's right. That mugwumps, I think they used to call them. Your mug is on one side and your wumps on the other. But that was about 100 years ago. How do I know that? Anyway, the concern we have specifically, and by the way, I've distributed a memo to me from one of my colleagues, which explains in general terms our concerns. I think a couple of the specific statements he makes in here may be not exactly perfectly accurate, but I think the general sense of this memo expresses the concerns that we have. And that is that we are charged, Metro is charged, with doing the transportation planning for communities in the metropolitan region. Some of that work involves the development of revitalization projects in the downtowns and neighborhood centers around the region, and we fear that some of those projects may run afoul of the language in this bill. And the goal of these projects has been to well, first of all, we design every major arterial street in the metro area to accommodate trucks and buses. And the streets that I'm concerned with here, well, that's that is what I'm told by my staff. And so the concerns that we have are not around projects that are going to make it impossible for a truck to move through a hole in the air. I think there's a big difference between a hole in the air and no reduction in capacity, and I think the definition of capacity remains sort of in question here. The specific.
Can I interrupt you just a minute? I want to apologize to everyone. I am summoned and double booked today, and so I'm going to be turning the chair over to my very able vice chair, and I want to also say at the end if you'll evaluate which bills you perhaps are not going to be able to get to this afternoon so that those in the audience would not be left waiting. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I indicated at the beginning, our concern is over the language that prohibits reductions in capacity and trying to figure out exactly what that means on the facilities in our region. The discussion of the previous panel left me even further confused about if the highways that are mentioned in the Dash 4s were going to be exempted from the prohibition on reductions in capacity. I think my problem could be easily solved by adding a couple of facilities in our region to the Dash 4s, but I don't think that's the effect of the Dash 4s. And so let me just mention the highways that are of concern to me. Highway 43 between Lake Oswego and West Lynn, where there are a couple of projects that are scheduled and programmed and I believe funded, and also Highway 8 through your district, I believe, Senator Starr, through Hillsborough, Forest Grove, and Cornelius, where there are several projects as well. Now, if you look at the memo that I sent up there, the last section that says affected areas in the metro region, it says the following areas and projects would be directly and likely adversely affected. I would like to, when I said maybe some inaccuracies, I want to change that word to might, because I think there's some question as to exactly whether the projects that are proposed actually would run afoul of this bill, but I think there's some work that needs to be done to determine whether that's the case. And my conversations with Mr. Russell have led to several possible solutions to our concerns, and But as the bill as it stands, we remain concerned. And so I just wanted to get on the record those concerns and want to continue to work to resolve them. The possible resolutions would be to exempt those facilities from the prohibition on capacity reduction here, to get them removed from the National Highway System. But I understand that for other reasons, we would not want to have Highway 8 removed from the National Highway System, or to seek the exemptions from the OTC that are described in the existing law, lines 12 to 15 of the bill that was, I believe, created, the language created by OTF3 last session. So that's my testimony for now, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Randy, thank you so much for your testimony.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr.
I am I'm intrigued by your testimony from Metro. Have you had any input from Hillsborough, Cornelius, Fort Forest Grove that they have problems with this bill?
I personally have not met Senator Starr. However, I think it's fair to say that our transportation planning department is not planning these projects in those communities in, without consultation with those communities. And I'd be glad to get you a more detailed answer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as the senator that represents those three communities, I've had some conversations, and I have found no concern as city officials that I've talked to related to those proposed projects. I'm also interested in at least one bullet point in your memo. And I understand you're not the author of the memo.
Sure.
But it's on the back page, the second bullet point. It just says most top down in quotes designs determined at the state or regional level tend to ignore critical local concerns. I just find that interesting. That's in a metro. Memo. It seems like Metro picks and chooses when they're concerned about local concerns and when they're not.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr. However, my guess is that it was referring to the regions of ODOT, which are quite a bit larger than our region. And I'd be glad to find out about that as well.
Work on a speed.
As usual.
I'm going to interrupt the testimony here for just a moment in view of the fact that we have about 8 more people to testify on this bill alone. We are going to not take action on Senate Bill 70, Senate Bill 998, Senate Bill 680, SJM 7, or Senate Bill 1007 today.
I see today's Wednesday, so the next time that be up would be on Monday.
Nearest they could be up on Monday, yes.
Okay. I just want to, before you close those out, I didn't know if you wanted to roll those over, carry them over so they're there, then staff can make the changes, or we probably have enough time for them to actually give notice. I just want to make sure we don't go outside 48 hours or inside 48 hours.
So our next beyond would be in we're going to be on the road on Friday, and then it'll be Monday, so we would have 48 hours.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I think we're fine. Okay,
thank you.
For the record, my name is Anthony Beda, and I represent Lane County at the Oregon Legislature. Just briefly, I want to endorse the connections between freight capacity and economic development expressed earlier by my colleague from the City of Florence, particularly as they pertain to Western Lane County and the Central Oregon coast. My testimony today is limited to the provisions A and B of Section 2 of the -4 amendments, and specifically on behalf of the County Commissioner, Lane County Commissioner from Eastern Lane County, we endorse the freight route designation prohibition expressed in Item A for the specified stretch of the McKenzie Highway, and on behalf of the Lane County Commissioner from Western Lane County, we endorse the same treatment for the section of Highway 101 from its intersection with Highway 126 in Florence north to the Lane County line and beyond. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I hope you got that testimony.
That was good.
Yeah.
Concise.
When you think about that's Lane County, and you got the east side going in one direction, you got the west side going the other. Tony, you did well.
Worked for 5 elected officials, recommend.
Thank you, gentlemen. you could have Chris Smith, Scott Bricker, and Len Goodwin, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Smith. I'm a transportation activist in Portland. I have served for about a decade as a neighborhood transportation chair. I also sit on the board of directors of Portland Streetcar. And for the last 3 years, I've been a citizen representative on TPAC, which is Metro's Technical Advisory Committee on Transportation Issues. In all of those circumstances, I've observed great respect for the importance of freight movement to the economy in our city and in our region. At the city and regional level, there are very intense efforts to plan freight capacity and freight routes that I think are critical to facilitating the movement of goods. I am very concerned about this bill. In fact, I would say I'm opposed to this bill because I believe it's a blunt instrument and not a substitute for good local planning. Yeah, in my work in transportation, I had never met a road or a street that didn't have multiple goals, and local planning is really the opportunity to look at all the goals for a given transportation facility and make the trade-offs that optimize the benefit to the community and the overall system that street or road may be part of. And I believe in making a choice like this at a very gross level, you really lose the opportunity to make the trade-offs that give the best result for the community. I can think of a couple examples in the metro region that Senator Starr may be familiar with. I had the opportunity not long ago to welcome Senator Starr to the opening of the streetcar extension to River Place. I would hate to think that I'd be precluded from seeing Senator Starr at future openings because we couldn't put streetcars on some of the facilities that you're talking about today. Concerned about portions of MLK and Grand, for example, that I believe fall in the national highway system where we believe we may be able to include them in a streetcar system that serves the whole central city. The other example that's already been brought up is Cornelius. I had the opportunity not long ago to attend a meeting at Centro Cultural in Cornelius, and because I arrived on transit, I had the opportunity to walk around downtown Cornelius, and it wasn't hard to observe how badly the pedestrian situation needs improving there. And the Senator's Washington County colleague, Commissioner Roy Rogers, made an impassioned pitch in the last MTIP round at Metro to get funding for that project. I believe that if the Commissioner was aware of the language, he would be expressing concern about whether that project was possible under the language in this bill. I would agree with my friend from Metro that the wording vehicle carrying capacity potentially means a lot more than the hole in the air, that it can relate to the number of vehicles that can get through a given segment of road in a given period of time, and have other implications that may make this bill much more restrictive than I think you believe it is at the moment, and I would urge you not to pass it out of committee.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Bricker, Policy Director at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and also represent the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, so bikers and walkers. I also have concerns about this bill, and I've been doing a good deal of my own research on it, and I have a testimony that explains some of those, and I'll try and walk through some of the points. My understanding is in OTA3 last session, there was the ORS 366.215 created the provision that wouldn't allow permanent reductions in vehicle carrying capacity on freight routes, and that's a fairly new provision that was part of a large transportation package. This bill, to my understanding, would, instead of tie that to freight routes, would tie it to national highway system routes, and our concern is specifically with that language of not prohibiting vehicle carrying capacity. For us, just as it goes for our general issues, we also want to work with a balanced transportation system, but my testimony today is focused specifically on downtowns and main streets of communities that have to balance their transportation interests, that need to have people walking across the street, and I think a lot of communities that have expressed concern have that specific downtown or main street focus.
Mr. Chair, can I just interrupt?
Yes, please do.
Scott, have you seen the amendments to the bill?
Yes.
The amendments to the bill seem to take care of the issue of the specific issue that you just raised, though, don't they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, my understanding of the -4 amendments is that it would make national highway system routes, it would prohibit the reduction of capacity of on national highway system routes on the state. The state national highway system routes, which includes Highway 101, 126, I think to further expound here, I think the issue of the access, the capacity issues of driveways and other planning issues involved with freight designations wouldn't apply, but the language of reducing vehicle carrying capacity would apply. That's my understanding of the -2 and -4 amendments.
So I know you have written testimony, but if we could, Mr. Chair, to facilitate this conversation, is that okay with, like, continue the question here?
Certainly.
Thank you. So the bottom line, and I think, Mr. Smith, your testimony is basically the same. The question is defining the hole in the air, as Mr. Russell talked about. Is that the bottom line? There's no definition of that in the vehicle carry capacity as it relates to what that hole in the air means.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that is a prime concern. It's prime top in my testimony. And talking to John Jacklin and others at ODOT, they have not yet come to terms with what that is. It used to be A through F, which was a roadway level of service measure. They're now going to more of a ratio of 0 to 1, where a small change in capacity could trigger this, and I don't believe ODOT has a hole in the air defined in any of its planning documents, but it might.
All right, thank you.
I will try to move this along quickly. I do think that this does circumvent some of the local planning, the freight route analysis planning process that was ongoing, and I think we've already heard a couple of other interests to add other streets to the list that wouldn't be dealt with here. I think the STA process specifically, even though it's a planning process which is burdensome, I think it tried to get to the point that there are different needs of the highway. So there's the needs of the local community as well as needs of the between the communities. Finally, I have some other streets that are in the dash amendments that wouldn't be fixed. Some of them were mentioned. I think Florence was mentioned earlier, and I'd like to say that the city manager from Florence said that he would not like to have to go back to the Oregon Transportation Commission to ask for yet another acceptance of his plan that he already has spent 6 years on working. So I hope that this language gets revised, and specifically we get the issues dealt with of what is the carrying capacity. I hope that we can stripe crosswalks across streets in Oregon, especially on the coast and other tourist places, without having to go to the OTC. Thank you.
Chair Whitsitt, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Goodwin. I'm the Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Springfield. You have in the record before you a letter submitted by Mayor Sid Lycan in connection with the first hearing. Mayor Lycan has asked me to come today to expand upon his remarks at that time and, of course, be prepared to answer your questions. Let me start out by saying that we certainly share Mr. Russell's concern for freight mobility. Our community and every community in the state depends upon adequate freight mobility if we are going to be economically successful. We are concerned, however, that this bill does not has unintended consequences that are of concern to us. I think Representative Barnhart had it right to express those concerns. I won't go into the details of the Oregon Freight Advisory Project. I'm sure that you're all very familiar with that. You are aware that it is ongoing. It is an attempt by OTC and ODOT to craft a carefully drawn system of routes where mobility restrictions should not be allowed. This process, this bill has unfortunately shortcut that process, which was to go to the Oregon Transportation Commission in July. Now I gather the process is on hold. I think I speak with respect both to the -2 amendments and the original bill. My concern is that, as the previous speakers indicated, the effect of this bill is to prohibit permanent reductions in vehicle carrying capacity on any highway on the national highway system. The unfortunate part of that broad brush restriction is that it impacts many national highway system routes that function as city streets. While we certainly are appreciative and sensitive to the Dash 4 amendments which exempted the McKenzie Highway east of the city of Springfield and believe those are desirable, the issue for Springfield is not the McKenzie Highway. Rather, it is Main Street, it is Franklin Avenue, and it is the McVeigh Highway. All streets on the national highway system within the city limits of Springfield that carry upwards of 20,000 vehicles a day at 25 to 35 miles an hour. These are all, would under this bill, all be subject to prohibitions in the reduction of capacity. I would point out that none of these routes have ever been suggested by ODOT to be included as freight routes. So they did not view them as things that would need to have a prohibition on mobility restriction. I think the legislation inadvertently fails to make a distinction between a national highway system route that is within the confines of a relatively dense urban setting and one that is outside that setting. In Springfield, the streets I mentioned, Main Street, Franklin, and Old Franklin McVeigh Highway, really do serve, in a sense, a freight mobility purpose. To move freight from the intercity system represented by the freight routes and the state highway outside of the city limits to their origin or destination or transfer points within the city, points where the freight can be picked up and loaded and moved along the highways, points where it can be brought to be broken down into smaller components to be delivered to local stores. Almost any major development that Springfield would consider will have the effect of reducing capacity on one of those streets. It will do that because it will increase the volume of traffic that uses those streets. As an example, the recent River Bend development had an adverse effect on the capacity of the Eugene-Springfield Highway, which is an expressway and clearly subject to restrictions on the reduction of mobility. As a result, that project is now going to spend several million dollars making changes and adjustments to the Eugene-Springfield Highway and to the intersections around it to avoid a reduction in capacity. That's for a development that is at least 2.5 to 3 miles from the highway. Similarly, in the east end of Springfield, at the east end of our Main Street, southeast of Springfield, about 3 miles, is the one major undeveloped industrial area in the city. We are in the process of extending a road to the northern boundary of that. We will then, in phase two, extend the road further within that area so that it can develop appropriately. ODOT has made it absolutely clear that under the existing standards applicable to expressways, and this road meets an expressway at Main Street, we will be required to engage in extensive redevelopment and perhaps even construct an interchange at Main Street and the Eugene-Springfield Highway before we can develop.
Mr. Beda, I think you've made your point pretty clear that within the city freight routes may not be an appropriate designation.
Right, and I think the concern I have is that this bill, by saying that those mobility restrictions cannot affect any highway on the national highway system, will adversely affect our Main Street, Franklin Boulevard, and the McVeigh Highway, streets that are critical to our development. And I'd be prepared to answer questions.
I'm fine. Thank you all very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And if we could have now Christopher Henry, Don Bishop, and John Jackley of ODOT, please. Please.
Whitsitt, Senate members of the committee. My name is Christopher Henry. I'm the transportation planning engineer for the city of Eugene. I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Oregon for the last 12 years. I'm here to speak on behalf of the city of Eugene. In opening, I would like to say that we concur in partnership with our colleagues from the city of Springfield in opposition to Senate Bill 894 and the Dash 2 amendments. I'm going to speak first to the Senate bill as presented and then later to the Dash 2 amendments. We believe that the existing process for freight route designation through the freight route analysis project and the work of the Freight Route Advisory Committee has been successful, inclusive, and effective. We believe that it's been responsive to local community needs, as evidenced by withdrawing Highway 126 East from the freight route designation. We have concern going forward that Senate Bill 894 creates the potential for conflict between access and mobility on the system. We understand clearly that access management policies are not affected by freight route designation, but that mobility is a concern. And through extension, mobility issues can be addressed through access controls. And so access does become an issue and can have an effect on the development community, the economic vitality and prosperity of our community. And we acknowledge that those needs must be balanced with the movement of goods and services and freight mobility. Our local transportation system plan for state purposes and our federally required regional transportation plan establish mobility standards. We don't believe it's necessary to adopt further, but I think that gets towards some of the Dash 2 comments. The City of Eugene and its local regional partners are supportive of mobility, freight mobility planning within the region, and in evidence of that, the Central Lane Metropolitan Planning Organization, through their Metropolitan Policy Committee, offered testimony to the freight route analysis project supporting freight route designations within the Eugene-Springfield area in Lane County, and that is in my testimony. With regard to the Dash 2 amendments, we believe that while they may be intended to clarify and simplify, that the effect is much the same whether or not you're talking about a freight route or the national highway system and its effect on capacity. Vehicle capacity is a professional science, as evidenced by the Highway Capacity Manual here, very thick document that speaks to the analysis of capacity and volume and delay and how we have determined the level of service on transportation facilities. It's not a simple definition and is a complex issue. With reference to the Dash 2 amendments that would address changes in mobility standards, again, our local transportation system plan and the regional transportation plan have established those mobility standards on these very national highway system routes, and we don't see the need to change that. In closing, I would like to again reiterate that the City of Eugene opposes Senate Bill 894 and the Dash 2 amendments, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. One quick one. Now, Mr. Henry, based on you having this book, I've never heard about this or what it is. It talks about capacity. We've been talking here in the committee about vehicle carrying capacity. Is there a definition that's used in the industry or as to that particular term? I mean,
yes, Chair Whitsitt, Senator Provansky, and committee members. There are more qualifications, but the simple definition of capacity is vehicle capacity is the maximum number of vehicles that can pass a given point during a specified period under prevailing roadway, traffic, and control conditions. That capacity can be affected by lane widths, shoulder widths, presence of obstructions, signal timing, roadway conditions, travel speeds, a variety of factors. It's not a simple number. It's not easily measured. It takes a great deal of study and comparative analysis with similar facilities to arrive at what is the capacity for a given condition.
Thank you. one other question to follow up on that. That wasn't what I expected to hear, so I have one other question, Mr. Henry. Mr. Russell has been attempting to try to give us a definition of vehicle carrying capacity, and what we have down now is the hole in the air. And what he means, and from the testimony I've heard prior to this hearing, is that he wants to make certain that the truck with their cargo portion of the truck can actually move down the road and not be hindered. Is there something within that book or that treatise that talks about that type of concept of maintaining the ability for the truck to be able to drive down the road and maintain that cargo section?
Chair Whitsitt, Senator Prusansky, and committee members, perhaps indirectly. Roadway capacity is affected by the presence of trucks, but I don't think that's what your intent is. Our highway design in itself, certainly within our region, is intended on the arterial system, the facilities that we're talking about here specifically, to accommodate freight mobility, trucks, and transit vehicles. And in that sense, that physical space, be it 14 feet high or whatever that is exactly, and let's say 10 feet wide, is accommodated. The capacity in the traffic and engineering world and transportation planning world relates to movement through time and space.
Okay. Thank you very much for the clarification.
Mr. Jackley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley with the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I thought it might be useful to start by going back to the previous session, which is why we're here on this bill, when the Legislative Assembly passed House Bill 2041, which became the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. And in addition to new funding for roads and bridges, the bill did a couple of other things. It directed the department and the Oregon Transportation Commission to give priority to projects that helped freight mobility. The statute also prohibits the commission from reducing the vehicle carrying capacity of any state highway that's designated as a freight route. However, the bill did not define freight routes. Senate Bill 894 would clarify this issue by designating the national highway system as those state highways whose vehicle carrying capacity, with a couple of exceptions that are in the bill and in a subsequent amendment, that could be reduced by the commission. The term vehicle carrying capacity, I think it's important to understand, is in the statute today. It's not something new that would be added by this bill or by any other amendments. It's in the statute, and I'll touch base in a second on what ODOT's been doing about that. One reason why this bill is important is because if the state of Oregon is successful in all of our state and local economic and job producing and economic benefit developments and efforts, we're going to see more trucks, more freight traffic, an indication of a healthy and a growing economy. At the same time, we have a highway system in the state that is not by any means going to be increased significantly in the foreseeable future. So when you look at 72% of all freight in Oregon being carried by trucks, and freight volumes projected to double in the next 15 years, something needs to be done for the state highway system, for this economic lifeblood to go through. I'd like to touch base also on the issue of capacity and definitions as it's come up in the hearing. The previous speaker was correct that in technical sense, vehicle capacity as defined by that manual is the throughput part, the number of vehicles of various sizes that can go through any given stretch at a given time. Our view of what this bill does is it vehicle carrying capacity are those issues and elements that allow sizes of vehicles to go through. They involve things such as lane width, vertical clearances, which have been an increasing issue, the ability of trucks to make turns off those highways to the mills and to the distribution centers and to those factories that produce jobs. So our view is that vehicle carrying capacity is the I don't want to say the hole in the air necessarily, but it's the structures and the building and the design of those structures that allow things like trucks to go through. Because this definition or this phrase, vehicle carrying capacity, is already in the statute, ODOT has started to look at what would be a technical definition of vehicle carrying capacity. And we have an internal work group that's been looking at it, and it's been looking at it from the standpoint of a couple of principles. The first is to keep it simple. The second is to minimize additional mathematical analysis, and then to focus on the ability of vehicles to get through that system, not in the standpoint of X number of cars or trucks per hour, but again in terms of lane width, vertical clearances, turning radiuses, and that kind of thing. Our preference in terms of how we move forward with defining this, absent any, of course, any legislative direction, would be to have our work group continue to look at this, make recommendations, and they would end up in the ODOT Highway Design Manual, because they're going to have to be synchronized with the other technical elements of the system. What 894 also does is it separates the issue of capacity, as I've just discussed it, from other things involved in a technical freight route designation that are very land use oriented, very important to local communities and to a lot of folks, but don't necessarily touch on capacity. In fact, the previous testimony by Mr. Tucker from Metro touched on some of these. Street trees, wheelchair ramps, pedestrian lighting, transit shelters, and that kind of thing. Those are involved in land use discussions on freight routes, but they don't necessarily have anything to do with the capacity of trucks and other vehicles in terms of height, width, and turning radiuses. The other point I'd like to make is that, and I touched on this when we testified previously on Senate Bill 566, is there's a very prominent role for the Oregon Transportation Commission in Senate Bill 894. Local communities can apply to the commission for exceptions to this prohibition on carrying capacity for safety, this is under the bill, for access, and then one of the amendments points out mobility standards that have been changed by the commission. That's a pretty broad number of exemptions, particularly when you look at the flexibility that the commission has shown in working with local communities. Local communities petition the commission all the time, every month, for all kinds of things, and the commission has a great track record of being extraordinarily sensitive to the needs of local communities when they feel that the facts warrant it and that they're in the position to give them flexibility on a wide range of policies, this and others. So in conclusion, I think it's important to distinguish between the vehicle carrying capacity as we see it, which is height, width, turning radius, and that kind of thing, from this whole other host of land use related issues that come with a technical freight route designation. The fact that 894 separates nicely the capacity issue in light of projected truck volumes, in light of hopefully more economic development and more jobs, from these land use issues, and then finally what we feel is the overriding role of the commission to provide flexibility. As you know, there are 5 citizen volunteers appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. They don't serve with any pay. They put in a ton of hours, and they are really, really responsive to the needs of local communities. So with that, I'll end and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jackley. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Mr. Jackley, I just want to make sure from what I heard your testimony is, because I'd looked previously in the word and phrases in the statute for vehicle carrying capacity. My understanding from your testimony today is when House Bill 2041 passed last session, it uses the term, but to date we do not actually have a definition for what that term means.
That's correct. It also used the term freight route, for which there is not a technical definition as well.
And can you please tell us where House Bill 2041, where it ended up in the statutes?
Ooh.
Or multiple, probably more than one place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I'd be glad to. I don't have the full statute in front of me, but I'll get it to you first thing in the morning.
That'd be great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for testimony, gentlemen. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 894? Not seeing anyone. We'll close that hearing. for the business with the committee?
I guess we're not going to work session on this bill today. It'd
be a tough one to do right now.
Committee is adjourned then.